All right. When last we left each other, a city was about to be destroyed. It's true. Let's see where we are. And so we have begun the story of Sodom, but we still have a good way to go to get to the end of it. So let's turn to chapter 18. We had talked about what the sin of the city was, and it's the, although later prophets, and I'll talk about that in a second, although later prophets identify the sin in one way or another, that the sin was arrogance, that the sin was sexual immorality, that the sin was encouraging evil, was depriving the poor of food, and usually a combination of all of these. We took note of the fact that none of these things is cultic. That is, nobody says they were worshiping idols. Nobody says they didn't believe in the one God. They're all moral sins. They're no ritual sins. So the destruction of the city is brought about not by idolatry, but by immorality in one way or another. This may be why the prophets talk about the sin of Sodom. Because one of the strange things, now I want to go back over for a second, when I say the prophets, I know, you know, sometimes when you study something that you haven't studied before and you haven't studied it long and you haven't studied it well, it's like hearing about someone else's family. Like all the relationships get mixed up, and even though it's very clear in their mind, oh no, that's my cousin's husband that you're talking about, not my sister. In your own mind, all the names and so on, they get mixed up. And so if I say the prophets, I don't know if it's distinct in your mind who the prophets are and why they would be commenting on Sodom or not commenting on Sodom. So let me just remind you, the Torah ends right before the children of Israel go into the land of Israel. So this is, we're talking roughly, let's say 1200 or 1300 BCE, okay? Solomon and David come along, the kings of Israel, a couple hundred years later after the conquest of the land. The prophets are a few hundred years after that, by and large, the major prophets. So for example, Jeremiah, who talks about the exile, the Babylonian exile, is already, that happens 586 BCE. So that's some, 400 years after David, some 700 years, 600 years after the Exodus and the entering the land, okay? The prophets almost always talk about moral things. Idolatry too, but they use idolatry more in a moral sense than in a ritual sense. On Yom Kippur, for example, we read Isaiah, and what does Isaiah say? He says, this isn't the fast that I want. I want a fast that breaks the bonds of wickedness, not where people just say, oh, I'm not eating. And to read, first of all, it's a remarkable thing to do, to read a prophet saying, I don't want your fast on Yom Kippur when you're fasting. But the point is that the prophets care about moral much, much more than they care about ritual stuff. Okay? So one of the things that is interesting about the prophets is that some Bible stories they talk about and some Bible stories don't get mentioned at all. Adam and Eve don't get talked about in the prophets. We don't know why. You can go anywhere from the prophets talked about them and it wasn't written down, to they didn't have anything to say about them, to they didn't know that story, which you can only believe if you believe the Torah was put together over a long period of time and not everybody knew every story. But whatever the reason, it is significant that they talk about Sodom. They probably talk about Sodom, first of all, because what are prophets always telling the Israelites? Repent. Repent or you'll be destroyed. And it's very convenient to have an example like Sodom where a city was destroyed. And second, because Sodom was destroyed clearly for moral reasons, so what they probably did was what people tend to do today, which is you assume that what people are doing wrong today is why bad things happened in the past too, right? The prophets looked around, they saw the kinds of immorality that existed in their society, and then they read it back into what happened in Sodom. Because we don't really get told what Sodom does wrong, although we have one brief story that might give us some insight into what the sin of Sodom was, which we will get to, that story we'll get to in just a few minutes. Well, probably today. You never know how fast we go. But, all right, so any questions before we go back to the story? Good. So let's go now, we're verse 22, and we're at the bargaining of Abraham. The men went on from there to Sodom, while Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Okay, that's where we are. So everybody found it's chapter 18, verse 22. And the reason I'm not giving a page is because everybody has a different edition. Okay. Abraham came forward and said, "Will you sweetly away the innocent along with the guilty?" Remember, we talked about that last time. The idea, he's making a couple different statements. What if there should be 50 innocent within the city? Will you wipe out the place and not forgive it for the sake of the innocent 50 who are in it? If God agrees to Abraham's request, he's not only saving the innocent, he's also saving the guilty. Because he doesn't say, what if there are 50 innocent, take them out. He doesn't say, what if there are 50 innocent, then move the guilty to another or move the innocent to another place. He says, you have to save the whole place. The idea here probably being that if there are enough good people in the city, they can change the city with the proper guidance and direction. And notice it says, Bikirba, which means in the city, and elsewhere he says, Betoch Ha'ir. And the commentators all jump on that phrase to say that you have to, in order to have people who can change a city, they have to really be in the city. That is, you can't live by yourself in a mansion and look down on the city and not get involved in it and lead a good life. You have to actually be betoch ha'ir, in the midst of the city. That's the only way that you can make a difference in the way people behave. So the other thing that I think I mentioned last time is that this is now the fourth time that Abraham has spoken to God. I'm going to read you the other times, and you tell me what's different about this time. Here's the first one. He says, "Oh God," I'll read where it is, but you don't have to follow it unless you want to. 15:2. "Oh God, what can you give me, seeing that I will die childless?" 15:8. "Oh God, how shall I know that I am to possess it?" And 17:17. 17:17, "Can a child be born to a man 100 years old, or could Sarah have a child at 90? Oh, that Ishmael might live by your favor." What's the difference?
This time he's asking for others, the other times he's for himself.
The first three times, it's about him. This time, it's about someone else. Now, what changed in Abraham, do you think? He's becoming a leader, right. I think that's clear. What made him a leader? And what, did he have an experience? Yeah. I think part of it is probably right that he's now got a promise of Isaac. And you know that your view of the world changes when you have to think about what's it going to be like for my kids. And so now he's concerned. And it may be that he's not only concerned about the world, he's also concerned about what kind of God he's bringing into this, his child into this covenant for. Is this a God who would in fact sweep away innocent with guilty? He may really be asking, would you sweep away the innocent with the guilty? I don't want to think that of you. And in fact, since I've already promised my child who's now going to be born into your covenant, I would like to nail this down before we go any further. So he doesn't actually give God a chance to answer. After he says, will you wipe the place out and not forgive it for the sake of the innocent 50 who are in it? He says, far be it from you to do such a thing, to bring death upon the innocent as well as the guilty, so that innocent and guilty fare alike. Far be it from you. So he's already telling God what God is like. He's saying, you wouldn't do that. And then there is what I think of really one of the most dramatic and boldest lines in the entire Bible. He says, shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? Which is very chutzpahdik to say to God. I mean, you know, really, who is Abraham and who's God? And he's saying to God, how dare you not be just? And remember that this is somebody who's had dealings with God. And so Abraham has here demonstrates an enormous, what he demonstrates actually is, I gave a sermon about this once, about the distinction in David Reisman's book. It was a book that was very popular some 30 years ago called The Lonely Crowd, between inner-directed and outer-directed people. Right. Reisman was a sociologist at Harvard. I think he's still alive, but I think he's long retired. And he said that certain societies and certain individuals cultivate different ways of being. They're inner-directed people and outer-directed people. Inner-directed people are people who have an internal sense of especially values. He's talking particularly about values, but not only values. And it is irrelevant to some degree what the society around them tells them is right or wrong because they're inner-directed. Such people can be moral heroes. They can also be impossible, right? Because they don't conform to the expectations of the society around them. They are inner-directed. Outer-directed people are very sensitive to social clues. They know what it is that's expected. They tend to be more popular than inner-directed people. They know how to adjust the way they are to what other people need from them or expect from them. Yeah?
One of the problems for me is we've read the Torah.
Oh, one second. Let me finish with the inner-directed and outer-directed. The reason I bring this up is because in order to be a moral hero, you almost certainly have to be inner-directed. It may make you, it can have very bad consequences socially, but it's clear that if you're going to be, Moshe is clearly inner-directed. David, I'm not so sure about, by the way. But Moshe is clearly inner-directed. Avraham here shows that he too is inner-directed. He can't, inner-directed people's sense of values is so deep in them that that it's almost taken for granted as opposed to needing to persuade people of it. And Avraham can't believe that God wouldn't do this. He can believe that God wouldn't do him certain favors. Are you really going to give me a kid? Really, can't Ishmael be okay? Do I really have to kick Hagar and Ishmael out of the house? When it comes to him, he might wonder. But when it comes to the question of global justice, he knows how God has to be because he's certain that that's the right way to be. And so, shall the judge of all the earth not do justice is an illustration, I think, of the nature of Abraham's character. He just assumes God has to be that way. Yeah.
Wiener, in the 10th plague, that God will...
Oh, we haven't gotten to the 10th plague.
But I'm saying, when we read it now, we've been there. Now we're coming back, and we are putting ourselves in the mind's eye of Abraham, and we're saying, well, we know you're unjust. And we can't always look at the Torah as...
We have Well, the question of whether God is just or not, actually, I wouldn't say that we know from the 10th plague that God isn't just. That's a much longer discussion. But right now, Abraham doesn't know that. Doesn't know that God ever acts in a way that Abraham might consider unjust. So I would... I think that it is... Whether God acts unjustly in the Bible is a long and interesting argument that we... I can't get into now because we have to deal with too many stories. But what is interesting here actually is the way it unveils the character of Abraham more than the way it unveils the character of God, although God goes along with him. Yeah. One sec. Yes.
This goes to the root of the problem of why bad things happen to good people.
And it does. And the only... Do you have something you want to say?
I was going to say, and it just... When something bad happens to you personally, you say, how can there be a God?
Right.
There be a just God that
And the only thing that I'll say about that at the moment is, if people said it as often about the good things that happened to them, the question would have more force, right? So rarely do people come to me and say, you know, Rabbi, I live in Beverly Hills. Why is God doing this to me? It's an amazing thing. And so we tend to assume that justice is consistent with bad things never happening to us. Justice is God should give us good stuff, good stuff, good stuff. Bad stuff happens. God is not just. But God's sense of justice may be different. Yeah. Yes. You're talking about the mishpat that he says in 19, right? That he says he should do. He has to instruct in tzedakah mishpat, and it's God, in part testing to see, to bring out in Abraham, not even seeing, but to bring out in Abraham, this moral sense. That's an interesting question, whether God has to teach it to him or just has to bring it out of him, the way Socrates, you know, brings out mathematics in that little boy in the dialogues that he pulls off the street to prove that we all have all this knowledge in us. It just has to be elicited by a good teacher. But it's that midrash exists in the Jewish tradition too, that you know all of Torah before you're born, and then an angel presses on, right? This is, by the way, called your philtrum. There's a useless piece of trivia. Philtrum, P-H-I-L-T-R-U-M, your philtrum. So other people share this useless trivia. An angel presses on it, and then you forget all the Torah, and you come into the world and have to relearn it. So that's what we're doing.
Something about what you said last time about the love between God and Abraham, I think that affords Abraham to be so inner directed and so courageous, because he knows he has God's love. He can afford to confront him. He can afford to be driven by his own senses.
Yeah, I think it certainly does make sense that if Abraham feels secure in God's love, he's much readier, just like a child with a parent, to scream and yell and so on, because it's not going to be a break. It's good, maybe an estrangement for a moment, but it's not going to be a break.
And I think that's what affords people who are inner directed to become inner directed, because they know they have the love and approval of their parents to begin with.
I would say I'm not convinced that it isn't also very strongly a sort of natural trait in certain people, because there are inner-directed people who've had bad parenting. There are inner-directed people who grow up in societies where parents are traditionally very distant, right? There are inner-directed people in all sorts of societies. In fact, according to Riesman, traditional societies breed inner direction more than modern society does. Because traditional societies, everybody is born with a certain clear moral code that is internalized very early, and everybody has it inside them and knows what it is, and you don't have to look around for clues. So in some ways that may be true, but I'm not convinced. You know, this raises the interesting, you know, the work of the Olliners, who interviewed Nazi rescuers, righteous Gentiles, people who rescued, who were clearly inner-directed people, by and large, because the prevailing morality of the society wasn't to rescue Jews. And what was interesting was some of them had affection for Jews, many of them didn't, some of them were anti-Semitic. But they all said, this is what you're supposed to do. Somebody's in trouble, you rescue them. I mean, that's what you do. It was self-evident to them. None of them were able to articulate, they didn't have a long rationale. They just said, my parents always taught me, or I always understood, or isn't it obvious? Somebody comes to your door and they're hunting him, you take him in. What are you supposed to do? As though that's what anyone would do. And when you see these interviews with people who say, well, of course, and you think they're being false, I actually think that what they're being is they're showing inner direction. And for somebody who's that way, it's like, well, of course you save somebody who's in trouble. They don't make the calculation that most of us, frankly, would make, which is, well, what about my family? What if the neighbors find them? What's going to happen to my future? They just go, well, of course you got to do that. And then they deal with it. Like that amazing book that I've recommended, and then I'll take both questions, by Updike, Opdyke. Irene Good Updike. I can't remember the name of the book, but you really must read it. It's a fascinating read. Lisa Silverman from the library told me to read it. And you know, whenever someone tells you to read a book, first of all, you don't want to read it. Right? As soon as someone tells you to read it, you don't want to read it to start off with. Because you don't know how many other books I've got to read, and I'm sure I wouldn't like what you like, and just leave me alone. So that's first of all. Second, it was about a Holocaust rescuer, and frankly, I thought, I don't want to read this book. But this is, she just died 2 years ago she ended her life in Los Angeles, actually right outside of LA. This is an amazing, amazing book. A great read and perfect for teenagers, by the way. And I can't remember the name offhand, but it's by Opdyke, Updike. Irene Good Updike. And we have it in the library if you ask in the library, or you look up Updike on, it became a very, very popular book. So if you look it up on Amazon, you'll also get it. And I'll try to remember. If you can't find it for whatever reason, just call my office and let Rebecca know, and I'll look up the name of the book and get it to you. It's nonfiction. It's her story. I'll tell you a little bit about her story. She rescued a Jewish family in the basement of an SS officer's house as she served as his housekeeper and eventually as his mistress in order to save them. It's an unbelievable story. And she was going down in the basement and feeding them literally under his nose without his knowing. And then one day he finds out. You got to read the book. It's amazing. Okay. Yes. Right. I told you it was a great book. It really is a great book. Yes. Yes, it may well be. It's possible that Abraham still wonders where God stands. And this discussion is intended in part to make it clear, especially now that he knows that Isaac's going to be part of this, although he doesn't know he's going to be Isaac yet. But yeah, absolutely. That is very possible. And by the way, before the one other thing is I listened to the book on tape, and at the end of the book on tape, they have an interview with her. Which makes, I don't know if it's in the printed book. So, yeah, go ahead.
The characteristic you're discussing, do you believe it's innate or taught?
The question is, the characteristic I'm discussing, do I believe it's innate or taught? I think it is capable of being taught to some people. I'm not sure everyone. And the reason that I say that is you know, the more experience you have with children and the more they learn, the more it seems clear that a lot of stuff is already, they come fully loaded, basically. You know, just like new computers. A lot of stuff is already in there, whether you can actually actualize the software. I have more stuff on my computer than I know what to do. I know two programs on my computer, and the rest of the stuff just sits there, you know, ignoring me. And every now and then, there's something pops up and says, do you want me to clear off your desktop since you're too stupid to use any of the programs on it? So I think that that's what it is. There will always be people who are sort of born very, very sensitive to social cues. And there will be other people who are capable of being trained in either way. And then there are kids who from very, very early on, it doesn't matter what you say to them, they just, you know, they listen to what they want to do and they're strong-willed from the time they're very young. So I think there's probably a range. In My Hands. Thank you. That's what it's called. In My Hands. In My Hands. Because their lives were quite literally in her hands. That's what it's called, by Irene Good Updike. And I can't imagine. It's one of those books. I mean, I love many books that I wouldn't necessarily recommend unreservedly because other people might not love them. But I can't imagine anyone reading this and saying, eh, you know, it was okay. Yeah. She was Polish, by the way. No, not necessarily.
Okay.
It isn't necessarily, which is a good point. If someone's inner-directed, it doesn't necessarily mean that they would be good. It just means that they have their own
way of
right. Yeah.
Stubborn.
So, yeah, it's a good point. All right. And we're back to the text. Okay. So, the idea, by the way, I wanted to also connect this, the idea that the righteous would spare the whole community, that we'll be saved because there are righteous people in our midst, ties very powerfully to an idea that runs all through the Jewish tradition called Zechut Avot, which means the merit of the fathers, literally, the merit or the merit of the ancestors, that that God will forgive the sins of the Jewish people because of what our ancestors did. In the same way that, you know, if 30 years from now, you all of a sudden that discover that your best friend's child is at the door, you're going to treat them differently, even if you haven't seen them in 30 years, than you would treat a stranger who comes to the door. It's Zechut Avot. It's the connection to the ancestors. So we are the descendants of Abraham and Sarah. Therefore, God will care for us differently than if God didn't love our ancestors. That same idea, that guilty people can be saved by their association with innocent people. Okay? All right. Far be it from you, shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? And the Lord answered, after that quite long speech of someone telling God what to do, right, which is a rare thing in the Bible. Moshe does it too. But I can't think offhand of anyone other than Moshe and Abraham that really tell God what to do. The prophets do in a way, but not quite as directly as this. And the Lord answered, if I find within the city of Sodom 50 innocent ones, I will forgive the whole place for their sake. Now, you have to know that God has to know in advance that he's not going to find 50 innocent ones. Even if you assume that God is not omniscient, that God doesn't know everything, God's already checked out this situation, right? We already said God went down there, and God said, I'm going to go down and see if the cry that has come to me is in fact legitimate. So God knows that there aren't any innocent people in Sodom. But God doesn't forestall the conversation by saying, Abraham, got to tell you, there's nobody there. What God is doing, although Abraham doesn't know it, is a process of moral education. Let's see what Abraham does. Maybe Abraham will leave and say, there aren't 50 righteous ones, I'm going. Okay. But instead, God says, no. One keeps recurring to the parent-child analogy, but it's the same thing. You want to know what your child will say when there's a moral situation. So you try not to preempt it by jumping in and saying, yeah, it's a good idea, but actually it's never going to work because of this and this. So God says, I won't. Abraham spoke up saying, here I ventured to speak to my Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Now, this is the first time, and it didn't happen at first. Maybe Abraham, in a rush of fervor, just spoke out to God. But now, all of a sudden, Abraham realizes that he has to acknowledge his own smallness before he can take another step. Yeah?
Is he being political here with God because he started 50 and then 40 and then 10?
It seems that way. Well, I was actually thinking about it both ways. When you said that, is he saying, I'm but dust and ashes because he's really feeling humble, or he doesn't want God to get upset at him?
Not only that, just going down.
Yes, I think he's clearly being, he's bargaining. He's bargaining with God. He's trying by small increments, he gets him down as low as he can. Just like you bargain for a different reason, obviously, but just like you bargain, you know, in the shuk. You don't start off by taking, you know, too much off. If you're selling, and Abraham is the seller, remember, he'll say, okay, I'll go down 5. And you say, well, 5 is good, but really it's not, I still don't want it. That's what God says, I'm still going to destroy him. So Abraham says, well, I'll go down 10. And keeps going and going and going until he gets to a price that he thinks is so low that he can't go beneath it. Why he thinks that, we'll come to in a second, but yeah. How low he'll go. Right. Yeah, and that raises an interesting question, which is why he stops at 10. which we'll have to take up in a minute. Why doesn't he stop at one? Yeah.
Given that, you know, each word in the Bible is, you know, so important, I spent an awful lot of time on this subject area.
It's true. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, you know, what is said about the fact that this is, that bargaining is so long.
Yeah, let's say that. That's a really interesting question. Why do we spend so much time on the bargaining? Let's go through the whole thing and see if we can find a reason for it. Okay, so, but he spoke to him again and said, what if 40 should be found there? And he answered, I will not do it for the sake of 40. And he said, let not my Lord be angry if I go on. What if 30 should be found there? And he answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, I venture again to speak to my Lord. What if 20 should be found there? And he answered, I will not destroy for the sake of 20. And he said, let not my Lord be angry if I speak but this last time. So he's already signaling him, I know this is as far down as I can go. What if 10 should be found there? And he answered, I will not destroy for the sake of 10. When the Lord had finished speaking to Abraham, he departed, and Abraham returned to his place. Okay, so first of all, God, it notes that God doesn't leave till God has finished speaking. Right? In other words, once this is clearly concluded, God leaves. And part of it is, I think, the Bible is giving this space to show how important it is to God. God stayed through this whole dialogue, even though God knew the answer. I mean, sat through the whole thing, even though he knew where it was going to end up. It was going to end up that there weren't going to be 10, and he's going to destroy the place. But nonetheless, he sits through 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. Why? Because it's not just important for Abraham, but the moral lesson is so critical. Here's Abraham. God will take time to listen to Abraham argue for the lives of people who have no connection to him. Now, there are those who say that the reason that Abraham argues is because he does have a connection. Who is his connection? Lot lives there. Right. Although Abraham is arguing for all the cities, but Abraham never says, can I just go and take Lot out of the city? Which, if he only cared about Lot, would seem to be the logical thing to do. If God says, I'm going to destroy the city, you don't challenge the creator of the universe and call him unjust, or at least suggest that he might be unjust. You just say, I understand, let me just go get Lot, my cousin, whom you know, my nephew, and bring him out of the city. But Abraham doesn't do that. So I think it's clearly intended not just as a sign that Abraham, that Lot is there, but that Abraham has an abstract concern for the welfare of human beings that is not himself. And that makes sense because that's the essence of his mission. Remember, his mission is not supposed to be to save Jews. There are no Jews. His mission is supposed to be to save the world, because God destroys the world with Noah. God is fed up with the world with Tower of Babel. And then God says, okay, I got to pick one people, and through them the world will be blessed. Well, the world's not going to be blessed through them if Abraham doesn't care about them. Yeah. Right.
But how can I pledge to them you're not going to eventually destroy us if we're innocent?
Okay, in a living sense,
amongst,
right.
You know, and living amongst
right.
people who aren't.
Who aren't innocent.
How am I going to protect us eventually if I see how you're operating out there?
I guess it's true in a way, what you're saying, that every question that that a child asks about a parent's behavior is ultimately about them too, right? I mean, you watch your parents in a public sphere in part to learn what to do, but also in part to learn who they are. So that does make sense, that Abraham is testing God because he wants to know about his own fate and the fate of his, you know, children, grandchildren, so on. Especially since God has already told Abraham that they're going to be slaves in a land not theirs. So God has already signaled to Abraham that he is willing to let people suffer for his purposes. I want to read you, yeah.
How are children accounted for in this negotiation? Can it be argued that...
They're not. They're not. Innocent people, he says. Innocent people. He doesn't say anything about, well, obviously there are innocent children. Doesn't say it. From which you can conclude whatever you want, but it doesn't seem, for whatever, let me put it this way, for the purpose of the story, there aren't 50 innocent children in Sodom, or even 10, apparently. This is what Leonard Cass says. Cass says, and this is a very interesting idea, Cass says that in part, God is trying to educate Abraham in God's perspective. That is, God wants Abraham to understand what it is to be God. That's why he stops at 10. Because from God's perspective, first of all, Abraham has to accept the destruction of Lot. Because right now, and Cass makes this point, which is a good point, Abraham doesn't know that Lot is going to be saved. God doesn't say, don't worry about your nephew, I'm going to take care of him. God just says, if there are 10 righteous, I'll save it. If not, I'm destroying it. And God's perspective is he's only going to save the innocent with the guilty if the innocent can make a difference. And if not, not. That's the way, and that is in fact the way the world works, right? I mean, that's what happens. If you go to war with a nation, what gives you the legitimacy to kill innocent people as well as guilty people, which you do? What gives you the legitimacy is that the innocent people are not powerful enough in the society to overturn the prevailing rulership of the society. And therefore, even though they may be individually innocent, judged collectively, the society is guilty and will suffer, right? Why do you bomb Dresden, where there was tremendous suffering and destruction? The rationale is because whatever good people were in Dresden, they certainly weren't powerful enough to change the nature of Germany, so it has to be changed from the outside, and the people who live in it have to suffer. That's God's perspective. That's the perspective from above that Abraham is learning, which is going to recur, by the way, in Egypt, and it's going to recur in Canaan, when there's a conquest of Canaan, again and again. I just wrote a review of a book called The Jewish Prison, and in part of it, I talked about the French writer Balzac, who said that every great fortune is founded on a great crime. You know, if you go back far enough to the Gettys or the Rockefellers or the, whoever it is, you find some, what's that? Kennedy. Well, he said a great crime, not several. So I didn't mention it. Do you know Kennedy's famous telegram to his father when he asked him for campaign funds and his father sent him money and he said, but this is all you're getting because I'm not paying for a landslide, So you pay him just enough to win, but not to win big. But anyway, so I said that the same thing was true. What's true about great fortunes is also true about countries. Every country is founded on a crime. But some countries are lucky enough that their crime is so far in the past that people don't remember it anymore. I don't know what crime founded, Greenland. But I assure you that there was a native population that was wiped out when it was conquered. As America, America's crime is sort of in historical memory, but we don't talk about it very much. In England, we sort of talk about the Norman invasion, but not very much, right? Because it's already 1066, and that's a long time ago. Israel, the crime is recent. And therefore, it's in historical memory. And it's inevitable that every country, you can't found a country without some segment of the population opposing that movement, and the country gets founded or it doesn't. And the same thing is true here. God can't morally educate a whole society if there isn't a sufficient critical mass, and the same thing happens again in Egypt, in Canaan, and so on, which is why in the ancient world did people kill men, women, and children? Right? What was the idea? Or take women slaves and still kill children? Because children grow up. And they grow up resenting the conquering power, and you're growing within your society a fifth column. That is, a group of people who aren't loyal to you and want to destroy you. And, you know, I mean, if you're charged with preserving your society, that's what you do. Yeah.
Is this the first time that Ken has been mentioned in the significance of Dominion?
As far as I know, it is the first, as far as I remember, it's the first time, although it's mentioned many other times in the Bible, but this is, yeah, but this is the first time. Right, which constitutes sort of the minimum community that is considered legitimate, is a minion, is a ten. And this, by the way, emphasizes why education and transmission are so vital, because the idea is you need a critical mass in every society in order to make it possible for that society to change.
Die by God's hand eventually for not educating or transmitting my goodness. I might as well give it.
It's a very shot. Right. That's a very powerful. It's like Edmund Burke's famous statement, the Irish British political theorist, that all that's necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Right. So it is empowering because the Bible works on two different axes, and sometimes one, sometimes the other. One is individual justice, but the other is group justice. Just like in the world, right? There's individual justice and there's also group justice. And that is, in fact, the way when the teacher says the whole class has to stay over, and the one kid who wasn't talking feels resentful, they're learning that, in fact, when you're part of a group and everybody is part of some group, you can't avoid the consequences of the group's behavior. And even though you may not be able to have changed it, you still suffer those consequences. People always assume that life should treat them fairly, but life is too complicated to be fair to all individuals involved in it. It just doesn't work that way. Assuming that life should treat you fairly, I'll quote Mordechai Kaplan, who said something wonderful about this. He said, assuming that life should treat you fairly is like assuming that the bull won't charge you because you're a vegetarian. Right? So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work that way. He was a very witty guy. So the same thing here. I'm sure that there were people in Sodom who felt guiltless, but the city was still destroyed. And that's a painful reality. Sometimes I think that the way God is portrayed in the Bible is less about the way God is than the way the world is. That is, the Bible is intended to actually show us the way the world works, and this is, in fact, the way the world works. Yeah?
I would just say that because life is random, life is not fair.
Yes, I think that that's certainly true. Life is clearly not fair, right? I mean, anybody who thinks life is fair is blinding themselves to, you know, to much of the population of the globe, for example, where the kind of life we lead is unimaginable. And for that matter, to most of history, you know, where life was also. You know, if you're born a slave, which a lot of people were through a lot of human history, life is not fair. So
where is this?
Hold on one sec. Yeah. It's true. Nature is, you know, as the poet said, red in tooth and claw. In other words, vicious and destructive. I would love to find this book again. But I had a book as a child, and I don't remember what it was called, and I don't remember who wrote it, and so I don't know that I'll ever see it again. But it was a pond in a cycle. It was the cycle of a season. I remember the book, though, very well. And what they would do is they would follow, for example, a little fish at the beginning of the book, and then along comes a bigger fish and eats it. And you hate that bigger fish. And then it starts to follow the bigger fish. And you follow its life, and something else comes along and eats that. And then you hate what ate it, and it goes on until the end. And I remember how the end of the book was, but it was brilliantly done. And that's the way nature is. I mean, nature is full of eating and being eaten. And it treats human beings essentially the same way, that is, indifferently. Edward Abbey, who wrote a book called Desert Solitaire, said the reason that people don't like the desert is because it's indifferent to them. You know, you go to the desert could care less about you. And we try to create a world in which it feels like we're sheltered and we're safe, and that's part of our job. It is exactly part of our job. And that's why, you know, being natural only goes so far. Being natural is, in fact, you know, pretty dangerous. Antibiotics aren't natural, you know. Well, they are, but they're against natural things, too. Yeah.
So I'm wondering, what's the origin of the concept of fairness? What started it when there is no fairness? What made us think?
Well, I wouldn't say that there is no fairness. Fairness is something that's capable of being created at times and seems to exist in the world. There's balance in the world. So maybe it came from the concept of balance. I mean, there clearly is. There's symmetry. There's balance. There is in the world, you know, when you do things, things do come back to you sometimes. That's clear in nature, too. So I think there is a concept of fairness built into the world, but it's very uneven. Just like there's a concept of balance built into the world, but it's very uneven. A cynic would say that it was used as a weapon. Just like kids, you're not being fair. You're supposed to be fair. And when someone says you're supposed to be fair, it always means you're supposed to give me more than you gave me, right? Nobody ever says you're supposed to be fair, so take more away, except a very saintly child. But maybe. I think so, right, to the very beginning. Right, this is, yeah.
God, the man, can be a fairer or less fair society, and this is a classic example.
I think that's hitting the nail on the head. That's exactly about this. This story is about creating fairness, but at the same time, I think the story contains, if you analyze it, the seeds of the reality that there's going to be unfairness, even in your creation of fairness. Yeah. Yeah, you can, although you can't control, as you said, the consequences of what that will bring on you. And this is a big subject, but it's clear that the Bible goes back and forth on this, as Jewish tradition goes back and forth. Sometimes you're told, if you're good, you will get good. Right? Good will come back to you. Follow the laws of God, everything will be fine. Okay? But then there are primarily two books of the Bible that say the exact opposite of that. The book of Ecclesiastes of Kohelet, the race is not always swift nor the battle to the strong, but time and chance happen to everyone. In other words, maybe you'll do better, maybe not. Damon Runyon, who is a writer, said the race is not always to the swift, but that's the way to bet. So, for what it's worth. And the other book that talks about this even more dramatically and more powerfully is the book of Job, right? Which is a clear statement of it doesn't matter how good you are, bad things can happen to you. Job is the best person in the world. The omniscient narrator of the book says he's good. God says he's good, and he still gets it in the neck. So
giving up our attachment to the outcome,
which is like the
Zen thing.
I suppose if you don't care about the outcome, then it makes it easier to live with whatever outcome there is. The downside of that is if you don't care about the outcome, you're less likely to work hard for a good one. So there are people who have argued, although this is a very, very uncertain argument, but there are people who have argued that the reason that modern technology and medicine and science arose in the Western world is because there wasn't this quiescent, this quiet, this acceptance, this attitude of, well, whatever happens, happens. And instead, there was this attitude of, this is unacceptable, and we have to find a way around it. And so you get people who give their lives to experiment because they need not just to accept the natural world, but to change it. And we are, for better or worse, the Western world is are creatures of an attempt to clearly change the way the world is. And I'll close with this. Daniel Boorstin, who was the Librarian of Congress, wrote a book called The Creators. And in it, he says that the reason that science and technology arose in the Western world is because it was Judaism, Christianity, and Islam that gave the world, originally Judaism, the idea of a God as a creator, and the idea that you are supposed to imitate God. And therefore, the idea of creativity, the idea of creation, of making new things, is at the very heart of the Western tradition. So, have a good day. Go out and make something.